Looking out at the universe is a remarkable endeavor in terms of discovery. We know that there's a whole lot out there, from the star and the planets in our own solar system to all of the exoplanets and stars well beyond where we are just locally here in space. And yet, there's kind of a blurry line between star and planet. If you make a planet too big or too massive, it doesn't just become a gas giant, but it starts undergoing nuclear reactions in its core. It starts becoming very hot, and it starts, if you make it massive enough, initiating hydrogen into helium fusion, that proton-proton chain, and becoming a true full-fledged star. But what is it that exists in that sort of blurry region? What exists in those almost but not quite stars? And how can we learn about these objects to teach us about not only how our own solar system came to be, but how all of the stars and planets and everything in between came to be the way it is? Find out what's lying there on the frontiers of science in this edition of the Starts With a Bang podcast. The new discoveries we make in astronomy are always driven by a few different things. They're driven by people looking with superior instruments at both objects we knew to look at and also in places that we didn't necessarily know we were going to find something interesting. And it's through these new capabilities, with new observatories, with new instruments, and with new techniques for observing, that we've unlocked some remarkable features, that we've unlocked some remarkable discoveries about just exactly how these interesting objects in our universe exist and how they behave. And here to guide us through the science of brown dwarfs and how instrumentation helps drive some of our advances there, I'm so pleased to welcome to the program Dr. Brittany Miles. Brittany got her PhD in astronomy from the University of California at Santa Cruz and is currently a 51 Pegasi B Fellow and Presidential Fellow at the University of Arizona, where she works at Stewart Observatory. Brittany, I'm so pleased to have you here and welcome to the program.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask, I remember back when we were imaging these sort of, I'm too small and low in mass to be a star, but I'm way bigger, more massive and hotter than a planet like Jupiter. When we were directly imaging these brown dwarfs for the first time, you know, back in the 1990s or so, here we are in 2023, you know, some 30 plus years after we made these first observations of these, I don't know, I call them failed stars. To someone who was like, okay, it's amazing that we're able to observe these, what were some big questions that someone might have had about these brown dwarfs or these failed stars 30 years ago that we know the answer to today?
That's a really good question. So actually this, I'm about as old as this field. I just turned 30. And so
congratulations and happy birthday.
Thank you. So I've read some of those older papers from like the 90s and the 2000s. And I think some of the basic questions I take for granted now is just what is in the atmospheres of these kind of these brown dwarf and planet like objects. So back in the day, all people saw was that, oh, these things look really red compared to stars, but now we can take spectra and see that they have things like carbon monoxide, water, methane, things you see on Earth. And now we're in a phase of characterization, actually being able to study one object really well versus looking for, you know, tens or hundreds of objects that are brown dwarfs. That's how big of a shift we've seen.
So we're not really just like searching for these and trying to do population studies of them anymore. We're really saying, look, we understand what these objects are like as a general class of object. But now we can start looking at individual details, things like atomic and molecular signatures from their atmospheres. And this is kind of interesting because for a planet, I think I understand what an atmosphere is. You have sort of these gases in a gas phase that won't make a solid surface. But for something like a star or a brown dwarf, you know, if I were to say what is our sun's atmosphere, what would I be talking about? Would I be talking about that outer layer of the photosphere? Would I be talking about something above the photosphere? Would I be going out all the way into the corona? And if I turn that question then and go to a brown dwarf, what am I talking about when I'm talking about a brown dwarf's atmosphere?
That's interesting. So just to make a layer-to-layer comparison, so the photosphere in a brown dwarf is typically, like, if you had to, you know, plant your feet in the atmosphere of a brown dwarf, basically throughout the whole thing, you'd be looking at layers and layers of gas. And so no matter where you are, even if it's above or below the photosphere, there's probably some gas and it's either really dense or hot compared to what you see on like Earth or something like that. Now, compared to a star, it may not be molecular gas. It will probably be something that's too hot to form a gas. Probably the biggest thing is this probably won't be gas in your average star. Some really cold stars do have gases, but I would say the difference is just the temperature and pressures you would feel if you were in the atmosphere. Stars tend to be hotter and higher pressure at the same like photospheric level. And then in terms of like the corona and these extended emission features you would see in like the UV and X-rays for stars, we're still trying to figure out if brown dwarfs have those same features. And so stars are not solved, but some of those extended features may be related to magnetic fields and things like that. But for brown dwarfs, we're still just kind of scratching the surface of understanding, do these brown dwarfs have strong enough dynamos to produce those similar features? And so there's been work in the radio and stuff to kind of figure that out.
You know, that's really interesting. You've already hit on something that I think is so important in all of astronomy that I still think the general public doesn't have a great appreciation of. And that is, when you are studying an object or a class of objects in space, you don't want to just look at it in one narrow wavelength or one narrow set of wavelengths of light. You really can learn a whole lot more about what's going on with this object inside and out if you take a multi-wavelength approach. So for brown dwarfs, if I was looking in, you know, visible light or ultraviolet light, I imagine I'd be having pretty terrible of a time trying to extract lots of useful information about it, because, you know, the reason these are brown dwarfs is because these are comparison with like red dwarfs, which are low mass, cool stars, or yellow dwarfs like our sun, or white dwarfs, which are generally a little bit hotter than the sun, but are tiny, small, compact stellar remnants. These are brown dwarfs because most of the light they emit is in the infrared. They're not in the visible portion of the spectrum. So what is the importance of multi-wavelength astronomy when we're asking about objects like these brown dwarfs or the most massive planets that are not quite stars yet?
Multi-wavelength observations are invaluable because it's like taking the stairs to see different parts of a building. The infrared lets us see very deep in the atmosphere, and sometimes the shorter optical wavelengths can help us see what's in the upper atmosphere reflecting some of the light back at us. And so it's a good way to kind of figure out what is in the whole column of the atmosphere, how are those different layers interacting with each other. And a lot of this information is also important just for understanding different planets too. So I think a lot of people see brown dwarfs very distinct from planets, but they're also very similar and help us understand how atmospheres work overall. And so having these multi-wavelength observations help us test our models and how we interpret things.
You know, one of the big differences that I learned is, you know, and I'm not saying this is still correct, but one of the big differences about brown dwarfs when I first learned about them from planets was that, you know, in a brown dwarf, they say the core temperature is hot enough, which is to say somewhere above 1 million Kelvin, but still below about 4 million Kelvin, that it can do a little bit of nuclear fusion, which is to say the deuterium that's born inside of it, where it has one proton and one neutron bound together to make a deuteron. This is a heavy isotope of hydrogen, and it exists in some naturally occurring abundance that's, I think, a little less than about a hundredth of a percent of the total amount of hydrogen. That inside these brown dwarfs, you get nuclear fusion of deuterium. You can initiate deuterium fusion, but you can't initiate true hydrogen fusion where you undergo the proton-proton chain and make helium out of hydrogen through a series of chain reactions. But then I learned that actually most of the brown dwarfs we see, they probably aren't fusing deuterium anymore. They may be at temperature, but that deuterium fusion reaction that goes on inside of them, that probably burned to completion relatively quickly. And now they're just really similar to planets. The only difference is they're a little more massive and generally a little bit warmer than, say, a standard Jupiter or even super Jupiter-like planet. Is that still correct, or is there more nuance to it than that?
I think there is more nuance to that. I wouldn't... So let's take a few steps back. So whether or not a brown dwarf can burn deuterium or not is a little bit dependent on the mass of it. And a lot of these objects, we don't have direct mass measurements. So typically we're adding up all the light and all these wavelengths, estimating the luminosity, going back to some theorist models and taking a guess at the mass. So that is one uncertainty in answering that question on, like, what's the limit on, like, what's that lower limit on how, like, what's the lower limit of a brown dwarf's mass to where it can burn deuterium? Does that overlap with any true planet we have seen today? And then the next part that I want to address is that deuterium can leave signatures in other molecules. So you can have things like deuterated methane, and other things of that nature, but we haven't taken the time to actually detect those. So I think to actually understand the big ticket question I think we need to answer with JWST and things like that is, what are the interior processes that we can actually observe in the upper atmosphere? Because if we can't answer that, it's really no point in making those hard distinctions right now.
You know, I think that brings up, talking about JWST brings up something really remarkable when it comes to these objects. As far as I understand, part of the reason it's so difficult to study brown dwarfs is because in general, they're far away. They're as far away as the stars are, but also they're faint. They're really faint. They emit very little optical light. They emit, even compared to a low-mass red dwarf star, they emit far less infrared light. So these objects are very difficult to find and identify. But once you can point a more powerful observatory at it, like the James Webb Space Telescope, like JWST, and you can say, ooh, this is really interesting now, because not only can I observe it with high resolution and with this large primary mirror that gives me a lot of light gathering power, but I could also go to longer wavelengths than I could have with previous observatories. If you observe from the ground, you can only see a little bit into the infrared, and where you can see into the infrared, it's really only in a few narrow windows at a few specific wavelength ranges that you can make those observations. But with JWST in space, you can see all the way into the mid-infrared, You know, from about, you know, where the infrared starts at about 700 nanometers all the way to about 28,000 or 30,000 nanometers in the mid-infrared. When you're talking about improving the capabilities of your observatory, what does that translate into as far as answering these big science questions about objects like brown dwarfs?
That's a good question. So, well, I think, so the planning for JWST was like, I was in middle school, so I kind of just using the observatory as is. But the major benefit of JWST is that it's not competing with Earth's atmosphere in the mid-infrared, like you mentioned, because we can only see through specific windows. So from the ground, when I took data on some of the coldest brown dwarfs, I have to spend 20 to 50 hours on a single target. Whereas with JWST, I can spend 10 minutes and then I'm done. So those improvements in astronomical facilities improves efficiency, so you can do more research and you can also do more science because you have higher quality data in the same amount of time. How to improve instrumentation is such a, it's an important point of discussion because you have to ask what are the questions that are important to the overall community. And there's a lot to, there's a lot to parse through when making that next big step, especially for something like JWST that takes 20 to 30 years.
Wow. I mean, I kind of knew that, you know, JWST, it is, it's our state-of-the-art flagship observatory. It has capabilities that no other observatory has, and it blows us away in a great many ways. But I also recognize that the instruments that were built for it, the NIRCam instrument that's its primary imager, the NIRSpec instrument that's most useful for performing spectroscopy where we break the light up into its individual wavelength over that near-infrared range, and the MIRI instrument, which is the one that allows us to go into the mid-infrared, these instruments themselves are more than a decade old. They were built, I think they were designed, and the design was completed in about 2009, and they were really complete and pretty much ready to go in about 2011 or so. So when you talk about advances in instrumentation, oh yeah, what's on JWST is a huge advance over all of the infrared observatories that came before, including Spitzer and Herschel and anything else that went up there. But also, I bet as an instrumentalist, as someone who, you know, focuses on these instruments, you sure do have a wish list for technologies we have today that you wish were on board the James Webb Space Telescope.
Well, that's a good question. That's hard because you can't just put anything into space, right? So, like, I wish we were a little more ambitious with spectroscopy, but one of the challenges with doing higher resolution spectroscopy in space is that, like, gratings and things like that can be really big. And so that increases, like, your payload and how much more expensive it is to get into space. And so I can understand the limitations around that. But that's kind of my big main wish, is just higher resolution spectroscopy, because that is so hard from the ground, because just little changes in the atmosphere, how much water is in the atmosphere, how high you're looking, just changes those little wiggles in the spectrum so much that if I had infinite budget, infinite time, I'd put a high resolution spectrograph in space with broad coverage.
Now,
go ahead.
I was going to ask you, when you talk about high resolution, do you mean you want higher spatial resolution where you can look at, say, individual parts of the same star? Do you mean time resolution where you can take an observation for a short period of time and get a snapshot and then take it a short time later and get a different snapshot that might get some different features? Or do you mean energy resolution and say, I want to say, when I take this spectrum, I want to see, like, things broken up, not just by, like, I want to see 1 nanometer resolution, I want to see 1/10 of a nanometer, I want to see 1/100 of a nanometer resolution. what type of enhanced resolution are you talking about when it comes to spectroscopy?
So I'm referring to energy resolution, but I do think the other two are something we need to pursue. So increase like spatial resolution, like how far can you see the closest planet near star in a picture? I think that struggle is for ground-based observatories, not necessarily space-based ones, unless you can put larger mirrors into space. Even though JWST is in the sky doing well, you know, around 2030, we'll have 30-meter size telescopes. And I believe JWST is like 6.5 meters.
That's right.
And so ground-based observatories will beat JWST in the resolution, but maybe not sensitivity.
I see. So are you saying, you know, with something like its coronagraphs that it's outfitted with, JWST, because it doesn't have to contend with the atmosphere, it doesn't have those same difficulties when it comes to, okay, I want to block the light from the parent star to look at this lower mass planet by it that you might have from the ground. But the only way to really say I want to focus on a more narrow region of sky is to increase the size of the telescope. And so JWST, it's a fixed size. We couldn't do better with that. But in terms of energy resolution, to say I want to be able to resolve these spectral features to look for narrower lines to get a better view of the continuum and a bigger view of these absorption and emission lines, that's the type of resolution that's really going to help me understand these objects.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, that's wonderful. I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge our sponsor. The Starts With a Pang podcast and today's episode is brought to you by Avenues Online, the virtual campus of Avenues, the World School. Avenues Online is an accredited Tier 1 private school designed for students from toddler through 12th grade who want to pursue a world-class education freed from the constraints of a physical school. Learn alongside peers living on 6 continents and in more than 20 countries with a global faculty leading the way. Learn more at avenues.org/SWAB. And now, back to our program. So, Brittany, I'm really excited about this, right? We had this class of object, these brown dwarfs, that it turns out may be just as numerous as up to maybe even the total number of stars in the galaxy. We might have as many as an equal number of brown dwarfs to the number of stars. But they have huge variations. Some of them are pretty warm, almost as warm as a low mass red dwarf star, and some of them are actually quite cold. What is it? You know, I know that when you cool something down, you get all of these kinds of phase changes that you can see. You have like species of molecules that can only exist in the ionized state at higher temperatures that become these colder neutral molecules elsewhere at lower temperatures. When you talk about a cold brown dwarf, something that's still warmer and more massive than a planet, but that it's still cold, what are the types of things that we're looking for, I would say because you brought it up, in the atmospheres of these brown dwarfs?
So some of the things that I just want to give an explicit temperature range so we understand how like close brown dwarfs are to real planets.
Sure.
So brown dwarfs can be like, you know, 1,000 or so Kelvin down to 250 Kelvin.
Oh, wow. So you're talking about colder than Earth. Like you're talking about Antarctic level temperatures on the surface of a brown dwarf at the lowest end.
Yeah. And so once you have colder atmospheres, you not only just have more complex like gas chemistry, some of the gases can get cold enough where clouds condense out. So as you go from really hot brown dwarfs to really cold ones, you may have carbon monoxide, methane, ammonia, silicate clouds can condense out, and at the coldest end, you can even have water clouds. And that's not to mention all the other little molecules that we've used in our models, and we're still looking for direct signatures in the atmosphere. So even things like phosphine that have been seen in solar system gas giants, but have yet to be seen in brown dwarfs just yet. And so there's a lot of exploration to be done here.
You know, one of the things that people always ask me about when I talk to them is they want to know about the possibility of life in unusual places in the universe. And we generally focus on Earth-like, or I'll call them Earth-ish planets, right? Where you have a rocky surface, a thin atmosphere, probably liquid water, and this mix of gases that, you know, contains carbon and nitrogen and oxygen and phosphorus and these elements that we know are important to life. But a lot of the molecules or components of a brown dwarf's atmosphere that you're describing, they overlap with this. Is it completely off the wall to think, oh yeah, you know, if you get one of these brown dwarfs with just the right conditions, you know, it has its own source of internal heat, it has clouds, it has water vapor. Could we, if we dismiss the possibility that some form of life exists in the atmospheres of these brown dwarfs, could we be overlooking a potentially very abundant place for life to thrive in the universe?
So just disclaimer, I'm not an astrobiologist, but I do think it's important to not just look at life through the lens of what happens on Earth, but knowing with what happens in biology, is there something that allows for that type of thing to exist with no surface, but with the right temperature and molecules? Yes, I think it's worth exploring brown dwarf atmospheres for potential habitability. And not to mention that some brown dwarfs may have moons and things around them. So I think there is a large unknown here as well.
You know, I think it's easy to look at where we know success is and to say, oh, let's look for more things like that. But I love the possibility that you brought up that, look, you know, we know that these brown dwarfs are failed stars in a lot of ways. They're, you know, whenever we have a star forming region, we can look and we can see, oh, look, we have all these clumps of matter that are growing. And, you know, they're going to keep doing that until all that cold, neutral molecular gas gets boiled away from primarily the ultraviolet radiation from the most massive stars that form in that region. Sometimes when that gas gets boiled away, you're going to see full-grown star systems, things that have, you know, central stars or multiple stars in them with their own rich system of planets. But I feel like it's inevitable that plenty of times you're going to see that gas boils away and what gets left behind is not a full-fledged star, but rather a brown dwarf. And will these brown dwarfs also have protoplanetary disks around them, and will they form full-fledged planetary systems around them? You called them moons for a brown dwarf, and I'm not sure what the correct terminology is, but is there any reason to think that the brown dwarfs that we know of don't have their own planetary systems around them, or don't have their own system of potentially giant and rocky and icy bodies orbiting them?
So that's a good question. So the first thing, there are brown dwarfs with disks around them. The first question you need to ask, can the material in that disk add up to the size of a planet? I'm not caught up on the recent literature on like what's kind of the lower limit, or what's like the lower limit necessary to make a planet that's stable around a brown dwarf. But I think that is something we need to really, that is a question for JWST, because you have a sensitivity to look around something that's already really dim. So that's a to be seen question. And I think probably the right terminology is probably companion, because there are a lot of brown dwarf binaries.
Right, where you have two brown dwarfs orbiting one another.
Yeah. So I think that's a to be seen for now.
All right. You know, one of the things I'm curious about is when you talk about making observations of brown dwarfs and brown dwarf atmospheres, this is something that I think is only really recently become possible, but that we're getting better and better at. I think with JWST, we're going to be able to get better features, higher spectral energy resolution. We're going to be able to better identify fainter atomic, molecular, and ionic lines in these objects. And as we see this improving, does this hold implications for us when we say, you know, if we can do this now for brown dwarfs, just imagine what we can do in the future for things that are smaller and fainter than brown dwarfs, like gas giants or maybe even rocky planets down the lines?
So I think, okay, let's like step back on what we can do on a brown dwarf and what can we do on planets right now. So I think the only thing we cannot do on like a directly imaged exoplanet right now is probably maybe taking data beyond 15 microns or so, just because I'm not sure how well we can get resolve images. Sorry, I think we can get images, maybe not resolve spectroscopy in the same way we've done for brown dwarfs. And so the issue with planets is that you need dedicated time and you need the facilities to actually do that. But I think for most directly imaged exoplanets, we can get similar data. It's just going to be lower signal to noise.
Okay. So that's, you're really just talking about a trade-off then. Like if you can see it, you know, and its signal stands out against all the background polluting sources that are there, like the light from its parent star, then it's really just a question of observing for long enough to build up that signal to noise to allow you to say, okay, here are the features about it. Here are the features that are actually inherent to this planet. So are you pretty much saying like anything that you can do for brown dwarfs today, you can also do for planets, as long as, number one, there isn't something polluting it, like a brighter source of light that'll swamp it in its field of view, and also that you take the required length of observations, where if you maybe needed a certain amount of time for a brown dwarf, but this planet is only 1/10 or 1/100th the brightness of the brown dwarf, you're going to need to observe for longer to build up that data.
Yeah, I think I probably would have some colleagues who disagree with me on this, but I'd probably high resolution spectroscopy is the big difference. But I do think if you want to spend enough time on it, you can get it. Probably the only limiting factor is the planet far enough where JWST can see it? And if not, then you have to try from the ground. But I think there are a lot of things JWST can do that people simply just did not try from the ground. And I think there is the argument that we should try to get more out of our smaller facilities and existing facilities as well. So yeah. I know there's quite a few people who would not, they're, it is hard to get a mid-infrared spectrum from the ground, but it's not impossible. But that hinders a lot of people from trying in the first place.
Well, let me ask you, what are the big limitations, right? So if you said, I want to get a spectrum of this exoplanet atmosphere or this brown dwarf atmosphere or this gas giant atmosphere or this rocky planet atmosphere from the ground, what are the big limitations right now? Is it a limitation of the instruments that are on our ground-based telescope that they just can't get the spectral energy resolution? Is it a limitation of the size of the ground-based telescope that we really have to wait for either the Giant Magellan Telescope or the European Extremely Large Telescope to come online to try? Or is there some other limiting factor, or is it all of them?
It's all of them, but I'll just go like step by step. So when you're taking observations from the ground, and direct imagers also use adaptive optics, it's a way to correct for perturbations in the atmosphere. And so these corrections happen on a specific time scale, and it may not be accurate if the atmosphere is changing quickly. And so there are residuals from the AO system or residuals in the AO system that are hard to get out of the data. So the closer a target is to the host star, the harder it is to actually take a picture, get a spectrum from that target. And then another thing is just resolution. So typically from the ground, people want a lower energy, a spectral energy distribution, just to add up more signal. But there are things like KPIC on Keck that are higher resolution that are people are kind of working out the kinks with right now. And then in terms of things that are beyond like 5 microns, there's just a lack of instruments in the first place that operate in that regime from the ground. And if they are, they may not be on a big enough telescope to accumulate that signal, but those are some of the few issues you have to deal with.
Interesting. Well, one of the things that I know we're learning a lot about, because they're really close by, is we're learning about how weather works on the gaseous planets in our own solar system. That this is an active area of research where they've made a lot of progress. Have we learned anything about the types of weather that occur on these brown dwarfs in space, or are they really still too far away given our observational limitations to draw any firm conclusions about that?
So actually, we know quite a bit about weather on brown dwarfs, and this is not my particular research. I just want to plug like people like Joanna Voss, my PI, Daniel Pai. They've done these campaigns either from the ground or with Hubble or Spitzer just to point out a brown dwarf and take repeated images and see how do the wobbles changes over time. And so from that information, we at least know that there may be like some, it's hard. So when you take a picture of a brown dwarf, you can't see the surface, right? But you can interpret those changes as like, is there like some hot spot moving in and out? Is it some bandaged feature that's getting hotter or warmer? You know, is it a patchy atmosphere? And so we're starting to kind of understand that at the bare minimum, brown dwarfs are not static atmospheres. They probably have some clouds or some upper atmosphere feature that changes how bright they are to the average telescope.
You know, one of the things I find really curious is that with a lot of objects in space, we see that there's some sort of gradient as you go from the mid-latitudes to polar latitudes, and that this gradient often gets more severe the faster the object is rotating. And so I was curious if brown dwarfs do this too. Have we observed brown dwarfs rotating? Do we see a difference between the fast rotators and the slow rotators? And is there sort of a latitude-based difference in what you see that can be correlated with how fast these objects are spinning?
That's a good question. So just for context, we do know brown dwarfs spin. They may have a rotation period on the order of hours. It can even be really short, like 2 hours or so for some of the fastest rotators.
Well, that's pretty fast.
Yeah, they're really active objects. But whether or not you could tell which changes are due to, like, I think probably, so if I had to ask this question or answer it, I think I would have to model a set of certain features, like put a band or a spot and see if it's different at the pole versus the equator. But it's difficult because you also don't necessarily know the orientation of the brown dwarf. So it may be a little pull on towards us. And that's also where maybe you need higher resolution spectra to figure out what's the inclination of something.
Okay. So it really does all, you know, in a lot of these questions I'm asking, I'm noticing a similar theme that it really comes down to we need superior instrumentation if you want to answer a lot of these questions, or if you want to answer these questions better than we've been able to answer them so far. Maybe you can help me out, because I understand that one of the huge challenges of doing longer wavelength observing from the ground, like not just in the near infrared, but all the way into the mid infrared, is that the atmosphere is more and more opaque at those mid-infrared wavelengths. So is there a way that we can overcome that and actually legitimately hope to do sort of mid-infrared spectroscopy or imaging of these objects in the future from the ground, or are we always going to have to go to space to do it?
I think so. For isolated targets like brown dwarfs, I think we should mainly stick with space-based observatories for that kind of research. When we're talking about looking at Earth around an Earth analog around a solar analog far away, we'll definitely need ground-based observatories to tackle the issue. There are some space-based efforts, maybe to use like interferometry or things like that to detect Earth-like planets from space. But in order to get like an actual low resolution spectrum of an Earth-like planet and figure out, is it actually Earth or Venus? I think that is the effort that needs to be done with the ground. But I do know with like maybe the Habitable World Observatory or optical space-based efforts, maybe we could achieve the same thing. But we'll see where the community goes with those choices.
Is it really just a question of, look, you want to get these Earth-sized exoplanets and you want to characterize their atmosphere, and if that's what you want to do, you just have to go big? You just have to build a large observatory? And look, for as much as we love to say, like, well, you know, there's no size limit in space, well, there are size limits of rockets, and there's the size difference of cost, and sometimes even support, that it's just a lot easier to build a big thing on the ground than it is to build a big thing and expect it to operate perfectly in space. Is that really just the huge advantage of staying on the ground?
I think that's so, just like, that's a good question. I think when something's on the ground, it's easier to experiment with. If something breaks, you can fix it. But at the same time, if we aren't willing to make risks, NASA has like this level of technology readiness where they probably won't do something if it's not like tried and true and like, you know, they know it will work. But I think there eventually needs to be room just to experiment with things to make a big push in technology for space-based observatories. But right now, I feel like we're very risk-averse, where ground-based observatories can make new modes and things much faster than space-based observatories.
Okay, so really it's just the risk of doing something new is always pretty high. And if you have a high profile, expensive thing that you try and it doesn't work, you think there's just too much of a fear of bad public sentiment and public backlash against it. And so those things are going to be confined to the ground at first, and only once the technology is already established, then we'll consider, okay, now we can put it in space because we've done it on the ground? Are you saying you don't see a lot of, I hate to say it, but you don't see a lot of JWST-like innovation on the horizon in the future, where they're not going to say, okay, we've never done a sun shield in space before, but we're going to do it here. And we've never done an unfolding segmented mirror telescope in space before, but we're going to do it here. Are you saying that those types of innovations are just not on the horizon for flagship NASA missions anymore?
Actually, those are really good points. So I think there's a lot. So I think very much on the instrument side, but there's a lot of technological things just to make an observatory work and operate. And so maybe there will be some advances where space-based missions are less risky to operate, but maybe I don't have that knowledge of the field like some of my more senior colleagues who work on these things.
Well, that's fair. Can you maybe tell me, because I know this is something you are going to know, and you're certainly going to know it a lot better than me, what are some of the different challenges that you as an instrumentalist face when you talk about designing and building an instrument that's going to work here on the ground versus designing and building an instrument to work in the environment of space?
I would say in the context of Steward, I feel like it's a lot easier to say, I want to get this filter and try it out, or I want to pop up at this night and just see how this mode works and move from there. I have not personally gone through the process of like gathering funding for like a new instrument, but it seems a lot easier here than, or at least ground-based observatories at Steward compared to like space-based missions through NASA or whatever.
Is that just because of like we have lots of smaller telescopes, and if you want to see what an instrument does, just build it and put it on the telescope and let's see what happens, and it's a lot easier to get that done here on the ground where telescopes are plentiful than it is in space where, you know, no matter what you do, you're paying millions upon millions of dollars just for the privilege of launching it?
Yeah. And one thing that we can do on the ground that we can't do in space is visitor instruments, where like, so iGRINS is like that. This is a near-infrared high-resolution spectrograph. And so the instrument does its own thing, and then you can put it on different telescopes. So they've moved to different observatories, and it gives different places to try it out at their site. That's not common, but I think that's a model you can't necessarily do in space.
Yeah, one of the things I really liked about the SOFIA mission, which for those of you listening who don't know, this was a plane-based infrared telescope that would fly up to very high altitudes. It would take observations while cruising, and it would operate in the infrared. So it kind of had this best of both worlds aspect of, yes, we have a pretty large telescope, we can take it up above most of the atmosphere, all of the clouds, and so we can overcome a lot of those limitations where, you know, looking up from the ground is often like looking up at the universe from the bottom of the swimming pool. You sort of take most of the atmosphere away in those planes, but you also have the advantage that your technology isn't frozen in, right? For JWST, this thing is 1.5 million kilometers away. We are never going to change out the instruments on it. It's up there and that technology is frozen in. But with SOFIA, we could bring it back down on the ground. And if you built a new instrument or you built a new filter or you built a new, you know, thing to attach to it, you could just do it. You could just swap it out and send it back up there and see how the improvement works. Mm-hmm. I miss that. I'm kind of sad that that mission is gone, but I'm curious if according to your estimations, there's sort of room for that sort of hybrid approach.
I think so. I keep talking about how the mid-infrared's cool, and like it's something we just need to do, but I need to discuss like why the mid-infrared has these shortcomings with the community on ground-based telescopes. So I think one of the challenges is just usability and like how hard it is just to like, you know, there are very few astronomers who do mid-infrared science on the ground, even from space. And so, you know, understanding what observational sequences you need to use, how do you, when you get your data from the telescope, how do you even reduce it? And so I think we need to, as a community, need to make more tools that makes it easier to actually use the instruments that have all these weird modes. And so while it is good that you can swap things out on your ground-based instrument or whatever, if it has 25 bells and whistles, the average observer may not want to use that. They may want to just use a regular workhorse instrument and they know what the output will be, not something that changes every semester.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense. You know, I know how difficult it can be to get telescope time, and I know how important getting those key observations is to everyone's research. So I understand the drive to go with the tried and true instrument. Do you think that those constraints are, I don't know what to call it, maybe innovation stifling in a few ways?
So I'm gonna be honest, what is stifling is how the field works. So a lot of astronomers, at the end of the day, it's a job. So they're trying to get papers out quickly. And so we're a field that values quickness rather than thoughtfulness sometimes. And so they want to use that tried and true method, not try something new that maybe takes a semester or two of getting it right, and then you apply and get your program done. That's really hard when you have a set amount of years to make an impact and try to get a permanent job. And so it's not the astronomer's fault. I guess lucky it is, but it's how our field is kind of set up, really.
You know, that's obviously a problem that's beyond both of our pay grades to solve, but I do feel like it's unfortunate because a lot of people, especially a lot of young people in the field, they have good ideas. They have big ideas. They have moonshot level ideas. You know, maybe not $50 billion moonshot ideas, but like it's going to take more than just, you know, whatever existing technology and a, you know, the length of a graduate career can accomplish. I do wish that there was more room to say, you know what, some of these things are worth investing in because the science payoff is going to be huge. I want to ask you, and feel free to take some time to think about this, if you could say, look, it's going to take a little bit of money and it's going to take a little bit of time, but if you allowed us to develop, you know, mid-infrared imaging spectroscopic capabilities from the ground, here's all the incredible science we'd be able to do. You know, is there something like that that is sort of low-hanging fruit for you, where you knew if time and money weren't the big concern, we could invest in this thing and it would revolutionize astronomy?
That's a good question. So just relatively speaking, so when you're using a telescope, what you're actually capturing the light on is a detector. And so for most mid-infrared instruments, detectors are like fairly crappy. So they'll typically either have some excess noise that shows up in your images, maybe half of it has some weird noise, so only half of the detector is usable. And so I think if I could spend like infinite money, it would be just improving just the detector quality in the mid-infrared. Because ultimately you cannot remove the sky, but you can improve, you know, the detector you're trying to actually record your data on. And getting a factor of two is much more impactful overall, in terms of being more efficient, looking at more planets and things like that. And then another issue that is kind of specific, but I care about, there is this noise source called dark current. And so for some mid-infrared detectors, this dark current is very high. And so when you're taking a spectrum, you disperse the light into different wavelengths, right? So with the higher resolution you get, the less background is the issue, but those little detector effects still are on each pixel. And so dark current and other things like that are more of an issue when you're looking at higher resolution data. And so I would like to spend more time to minimize that. And so that's some of the things that I would like to think more about while I'm at Stewart.
Wow. I mean, that's really impressive. I'm not an instrumentalist at all. I think I did one observational project and the rest of my work is in theory. So this is my first exposure to hearing about dark current, but I think it's really remarkable to listen to you talk about how, you know, we all know that a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. And you're saying like, look, like here's a weak link right here that I think it's really important to strengthen. And if we strengthened it, we would enable a huge amount of science that, you know, that this is the bottleneck right now. Because it sounds like you're saying if we could make these observations, then all the things we're talking about as next generation, you know, wait for the 30 meter class telescopes, wait until JWST has been up there and time isn't at such a premium anymore, wait until Habitable Worlds Observatory goes up, you know, maybe these are things we could do. Maybe these are observations we could make from the ground with a modest telescope if only we had just something as simple as better detectors.
Yes, and I just wanted to highlight, I don't think I talked about the science I care about beyond like 5 microns. So I talked a lot about molecules and gas giants, but some of the biosignatures like ozone have these really whopping features at like 9 microns for Earth-like planets. And so if you can go beyond just taking a single picture and getting this wavelength information, I think it's very big for kind of understanding what these atmospheres even look like. Because I'm sure it will be a big deal once we take a picture of like a true habitable zone Earth-like planet, but to actually understand what's in the atmosphere, that's what I really care about.
Is this something that the JWST's MIRI instrument, the mid-infrared instrument, I know it has spectroscopic capabilities. Does it have the capability of resolving, you know, these ozone-like features at 9 microns for, you know, potentially Earth-like or super-Earth-like planets? Or is that just, no, you can't do that with the current instrumentation on the current even flagship space telescope?
Yeah, it's definitely not a science case MIRI can do, because the diffraction limit of MIRI is too big for like a Earth that's like, you know, 0.1 arcsecond away from its star.
Oh, so I get it. This is because when you go to these longer wavelengths of light in the mid-infrared, you have fewer, smaller numbers of the wavelength of that light that will fit across your 6.5 meter telescope. So if this were a feature and JWST were built for observing in like the ultraviolet and ozone was a feature that showed up in the ultraviolet, maybe it could do it. But because we're not talking about 100 nanometers, we're talking about 9,000 nanometers or 9 microns, you can't do it. Mm-hmm.
Or I think I explained it. I don't think I explained it well. So for MIRI's medium resolution spectrograph, you can, I believe it's an image slicer, but ultimately it combines imaging. It basically takes spectra, but from that you can retrieve an image cube. So you get an image at a bunch of different wavelengths. And so the resolution of MIRI combined with JWST is not enough to resolve Earth-like planets around solar-type stars. It can maybe do it for M-dwarfs or something, maybe Saturns at best, but it's definitely not, it doesn't have the resolution to get those planets, or the spatial resolution to get those planets.
Okay, is that something that will really just require next-generation technology, like not even Roman level technology, but maybe HWO, Habitable Worlds Observatory level technology?
I think so, but so HWO is a little out of my wavelength expertise. I think some of the challenges there are aberrations in the instrument itself, making it hard to image close to the host star. But I'm not sure, I'm not up well-versed on the technological advances to get optical observations done better.
No, and that's okay. I know honestly that the coronography for that is still in development. So, you know, it's like you said earlier, if you have this very bright thing that's very nearby, you have to make sure that the source you're trying to observe isn't swamped by that nearby pollutant thing. And when you have tiny planet close to a big bright star, like a sun-like star, this just becomes a difficult problem.
Yeah. I should say the discussion shouldn't be one path is right. There needs to be complementary information. And so with the optical, maybe you have more information about the upper atmosphere of an Earth-like planet, but in the mid-infrared, you're assessing more of the internal heat of the object. And so combining those two pieces of information, maybe you would learn more. But the community really needs to settle on what are our criterion for saying something is probably habitable, and follow-up searches for like biosignatures and things like that.
Yeah, I've been frustrated personally with people really restricting themselves to Earth-ish worlds. I wonder a lot about very abundant, close by Earth-sized planets that are around these low-mass M-dwarf stars. I wonder occasionally about brown dwarfs and whatever objects may be in orbit around them. And I also wonder about sort of these water worlds, these all-ocean worlds, because we know that even in our solar system, Earth is not the most abundant, you know, terrestrial rock and ice planet or moon with the most water. I think we're number 5 behind some of Jupiter's and Saturn's moons that are much more water rich. So I do worry a lot that we have this sort of like lottery ticket bias, where here on Earth we are a lottery winning planet in the great cosmic lottery of life, but we have no idea what the odds of winning a prize are. We have no idea what the other prizes are. And we have no idea whether what happens here on Earth is even the grand prize, or whether there's some grander prize out there that we just haven't discovered yet.
Absolutely. I mean, you're really preaching to the choir here, because I study what I study because I think it's important to understand what is the diversity of planetary evolution and how planets can appear to us? How are we different from other places? But I know that it's a very human thing to kind of understand, like, do we have a twin out there or something like that? But I think there is power in understanding the edge cases and diversity of planets, because it makes our case when we look for Earth, do we understand what it could not be?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's so interesting, just looking at our own solar system, you have to wonder, was Venus ever habitable? Did Venus ever have this nice temperate liquid water environment with a thin atmosphere that would have made it conducive to life? And if it did, what made it stop being that way? And when did it stop being that way? Was Mars? We have evidence that perhaps for the first billion, maybe even billion and a half years of its history, Mars was a wet, water-rich planet with oceans and continents and rivers and lakes, and may have had simple life on it, but we don't know for sure. And there are also interesting things about wondering about subsurface oceans on worlds like Europa and Enceladus, about subterranean liquid water that might exist on a place like Ganymede or Neptune's moon Triton. And that's just here in one stellar system, you have to wonder about the huge possibilities that are out there. Yeah, it's easy to say, oh, well, find a sun-like star and look for an Earth-sized planet with an Earth-like orbit and similar conditions to Earth, and that's a good bet for finding life. Like, yeah, I agree, that's a good bet for finding life, but, you know, I feel like that's saying like, oh, there's this huge cosmic ocean out there, and this is the eyedropper you want. Now let's go ignore the rest of the ocean. I think anyone with a healthy imagination knows, check the ocean, buddy. Check the ocean.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good point, because I think a lot of people, I wouldn't say a lot, I think a lot of astronomers maybe see the solar system as like solved, but there's still a lot of exploration we can do in our own home system, and it helps us understand exoplanets better as well.
You know, I've been aware of a lot of, I'll call it, contention between the planetary science community and the astronomy community, that, you know, we're kept in different divisions within NASA, like we have NASA astrophysics and NASA planetary science, and they do not talk to each other. They do not get funding from the same pool. They have a different science mission directorate. They're completely independent, and yet we're both trying to answer the same questions, right? When I think about the question of life in the universe or chances for life in the universe, I think, well, there's three ways to do it, right? There's the SETI way, where if there are intelligent aliens out there trying to communicate, we should try to be listening and we should try to be speaking a language they might understand. And there's the planetary science way to say, well, we have these nearby places, let's go there and find out whether there's life there, past, present, or somewhere in between, like it's dormant and seasonal. And then you have the astronomy way to say, well, go look at these very far away objects that we can't visit and look for biosignatures, or what I've been trying to train myself to say, bio hints of life that are out there. But I do every once in a while catch myself wondering, why are the people who are looking for life in exoplanet atmospheres not doing some of the same experiments and doing some of the work that the planetary science people are hoping to do, to say, well, what about life here in our solar system? What about life on that rock over there, right there, that I could, if I had the rocket today, send my probe to and go have the probe look for life on that rock right now?
So I guess I also have a question for you. What do you think is the most fruitful approach? Because these people know about each other, but aren't talking necessarily when they need to.
Oh boy, that's a big question for me. I mean, honestly, I've thought this since I first became aware of, you know, the space program and what it was doing, and what it had done and what it was working on in, I'll say, the 90s, when I was, you know, when I was in my teenage years. And I wondered why the goal was not to send a crewed mission to Mars with full scientific laboratory to analyze what's in the soil. Let's drill a core, let's take it out, let's analyze it the same way we'd analyze an Antarctic core here, and look for past life, fossilized life, dormant life, active life. Let's send that over there. Why are we not doing that? You know, it's now 30 years since I've been wondering those questions, and we are no closer to sending a crewed mission to Mars now than we were 30 years ago. You know, some people will disagree with that, but in my opinion, no, we're no closer to doing that. We've sent, you know, we had the Sojourner rover, we had the Spirit and Opportunity rovers, we had the Curiosity rover, we had the Phoenix lander, we had the Perseverance rover, and none of those questions have been answered. All we've done is we've said we found these hints. And my big question is, why are we not being more ambitious here in our own solar system of saying, hey, we have these worlds right here. Why aren't we looking about how far did life get, or how far did non-life get chemically towards becoming something that might have those two key features of having a metabolism and being able to reproduce itself? If you find those two features together, you know, yeah, there are going to be a million biologists who disagree with me and probably a few dozen who agree with me, but I call that life. If you have a metabolism and you're reproducing yourself, that's life. Why are we not investing more in that? We have people here on Earth working in origin of life research who are, you know, taking these sort of primitive precursor molecules and trying to get them to metabolize and reproduce. And very recently, we've come up with a new origin of life scenario that looks very, very promising, which I think is called nucleic acid peptide coevolution, where you have some sort of primitive nucleic acid. It could be RNA, or it could be a peptide nucleic acid, or it could be a different type of nucleic acid that actually, you know, will produce peptides. The peptides will metabolize themselves. And then because the peptide is encoded by the nucleic acids can bind to the peptides and make more copies of themselves and make more peptides, which can metabolize things. And, you know, look, I know this is very ambitious, but I feel like if we invested more in that, if we understood what was going on here in our own solar system, not just on Earth, but elsewhere, and we invested more in understanding how, you know, these molecules arose and played a role early on in the potential formation of life, or the potential way that life arises from non-life, that would inform astronomers to say, hey, go look for these signatures. Look for these molecules together. Look for these metabolites. Look for these fluctuations in something in the atmosphere that would be given off by something that metabolized. Because once a planet's atmosphere and surface, and I'll just call the whole thing the biosphere, once the biosphere becomes saturated by life, you start getting feedback mechanisms. And I think that seeing those feedback mechanisms is something we're going to gloss right over if we don't understand them. Like we might be observing those signatures right now, but we don't know what they are and we don't know what to make of them. So we're just glossing over them. And that's probably something that I would wonder about. I don't know what you think about that. That might be like 20 steps pie in the sky past what we're even capable of doing.
So I asked because I don't think I have a well-informed opinion about the best way to search for life. That's just like the cold hard facts on my end. So I'm always curious. I think in addition to that, I always ask, like, why are we even searching for life too? And so I'm just more of an open book now on the approaches to answering that question.
Oh, boy. Well, I hope I don't get a bunch of hate mail from astrobiologists who are listening to this and saying either, Ethan, we're already doing that, why aren't you paying attention? Or, Ethan, that's a half-baked crackpot thing, why are you even talking about that? But I do think, you know, yes, there's the big existential. We want to know, are we alone? are we a one and an observable universe thing where we're not only the only instance of intelligent, technologically advanced life out there, but life, period? Or is this something that is common? And how common is it, right? Just like we want to know about the very first stars and how were they different from our own, but how did they make stellar systems like ours possible? Just like we want to know about rocky planets and why the Kepler mission was such a revolution, because it taught us not only that Earth isn't that rare, but Earth-like planets are common, and so are all these other planets, right? I think there's a lot of value in taking a census of what's out there, just like you would want to take a census of all of the brown dwarfs within, you know, 50 light years, 100 light years, 1,000 light years, if you could, because these are interesting objects in their own right, and we want to know about them. For me, I wonder so much about what we consider essential to life. How much of it is just a coincidence? Like, no, we're here and we have this bias. We have Earth success bias informing us about what life should be like elsewhere. And I feel like, you know, if we find life anywhere else, that will tell us that we're probably not the only ones, and that us and this other one probably aren't the only two. But if it's just one, that might be it. You can get lucky once. You can win the lottery once. You're very unlikely to win the lottery twice in a row. If you do, probably there are other lottery winners out there also.
I got you. No matter what the answer is, if the universe struck the lotto twice, I hope it, the answering the question and the search to it helps us just generally be kinder and nicer to each other, I guess. I hope that makes sense.
I mean, I always hope for that too. I think it does make a lot of sense, you know, especially, you know, we've all been here on the world for, you know, the last few years. And I think we'd all like a world that was filled more with kindness and open-mindedness and this curiosity and the spirit to learn more about the unfamiliar. I think that's a universal sentiment that's pretty easy to get on board with.
In answering, like, you know, why search for life is in the inherent value, or it's the assumption that life is something precious and rare, but in our day-to-day lives, the way things are set up, sometimes we don't treat the life we do know with that same care, I guess.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, it's pretty easy to say, hey, I'm really mired in what I'm doing right now, and it's more difficult to step back and take a broader view of things. But I think when we do, when we sort of recognize where are other people at and can we meet them where they are to sort of bring an extra, I don't even know what to call it, an extra layer of humanity to them, I think that potential for growth and understanding is, you know, it just explodes. It's just, there's so much of it. Just like, honestly, in a lot of ways, having that kind of new perspective and that understanding, it's a lot like having a new astronomical instrument, right? There are all sorts of things that we know are out there. There's a lot of things that we know, okay, this exists, and there's this out there, and I want to study it better. I want to learn more about it. I want to discover more details about it. But also, when you broaden your horizons, when you open up what you can look at and what you can communicate with and what you can access in a different way, when you increase that, there's also this huge, I guess, call it discovery potential. There's also the, I didn't even know I was looking for this, and look at what was out there. I think we saw that extraordinarily with the Hubble Space Telescope, right? Back in the 1990s, it was a huge deal to take the very first Hubble deep field image. A lot of people were against it. No, you're not going to see anything. You're just going to waste all this valuable telescope time observing nothing, and you're not going to even see anything. And of course, they took the first Hubble deep field. It was done with director's discretionary time. So good for us for having a bold director at the time. And I would say that, for me, that's the most important Hubble image ever taken. That showed us what the universe looks like in unprecedented detail for the very first time. And I think that, I don't know, like, it might sound naive, you know, coming from a 45-year-old man, and maybe it is naive, that, you know, just like in astronomy, when we build new instruments with new capabilities that can see things as we've never seen them before, we're going to find some things we didn't expect to find that are going to surprise us. You know, maybe if you reach out to humanity in ways you've never reached out to it before, maybe you're going to find things there that'll surprise you too.
I got you. And thank you for sharing that perspective with me.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I brought you on here to interview you, and here you are asking me some tough questions I've never been asked before.
I mean, I'm not like just a response bot. We're having a conversation. Like,
no, I'm enjoying it. I'm just saying, like, this is, I think, my 98th episode of the Starts With a Bang podcast, and no one's ever asked me this before. Like, this is good stuff, Brittany. Thank you. I appreciate this a lot. You know, because there are, you know, I think part of the, it's easy when we're mired in our day-to-day research, our day-to-day whatever it is we're doing, we forget to even think about these big questions, you know, because the big questions aren't just, I want to know this or I want to answer that. The big questions are, how can we connect with humanity? How can we connect with one another to see the wonder that one another sees, to see, you know, what are these big questions that we should be trying to answer collectively, for the benefit of all of human civilization. You know, it's, yeah, like, having a new instrument is cool, and finding a cold exoplanet is cool, and characterizing an atmosphere is cool, but also, like, there are these big existential questions attached to it. I imagine you have some too. Would you be willing to share, you know, if you could maybe have some of these big questions answered, you know, what would you like us to know, and what would you like us to invest resources in discovering?
Oh, that's a good question. I think, honestly, right now, I wish we would, we definitely need to invest more time into just, like, doing blind searches again for, so this is, take a step back. Back in the day, when people were looking, like, trying to take direct pictures of planets, they would look at all the really young stars and hope to see a planet. But now we know that gas giant planets are really rare. So that's why there aren't that many of them. But because of transiting exoplanets, we know that smaller planets are more ubiquitous. And so we probably have to invest the time to actually directly image smaller planets in the future. And so I know it's probably not popular now, but we definitely need to combine, like, with, you know, with things like Gaia and, like, radio velocity searches, we know something may be there. and actually spend more time looking for closer in planets in the future. And even with like things like the LBT, just so we're not wasting time in the past or in the future when we actually need to take spectra. So I'm hoping that we, right now, we just lay the adequate groundwork so we can actually characterize and get good spectra to maybe look for these signatures or signatures for life or just hints of it, you know? But other than that, oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to ask, do you think there's low-hanging fruit that we're missing? Like, do you think, hey, you know, Todd Henry has his Recons program where he's trying to look at all of the stars within a very small volume close to us and characterize them and talk about, you know, what types of star they are, whether they're singlets or binaries or multi-star systems, and to sort of characterize them by the Morgan-Keenan spectral classification. And, you know, are you saying, well, yeah, and also, and we should be looking for planets around them, and we should be monitoring their radial velocities, and we should be seeing if there's the potential for low mass, short period exoplanets around them, so that when we do have these, you know, spectral capabilities to maybe do direct imaging of their atmosphere, we're not like, oh yeah, and by the way, we have to do all these catch-up observations to even know. Is this sort of like low-hanging fruit that you see out there that, hey, why aren't we setting the stage for tomorrow by doing this today?
So I don't think it's low-hanging fruit now. I think it's something we'll probably have to invest time with the 30 to 40 meter class telescopes. But also, like, I'm not a planet hunter per se. I'm more of someone who likes to characterize, but anything that like reduces anything that basically reduces the likelihood of it being a wasted time observation when we do need to spend 100 hours or something to actually get a good spectrum. Just understanding what's the probability of X, Y, and Z. If you see methane or whatever, does that reduce the likelihood of seeing ozone or whatever?
I see. So it's really more about understanding, you know, it's really more about collecting and understanding the hints today. So that we're better informed to do the more expensive detective work when tomorrow arrives.
Absolutely. And this also includes getting funding and supporting the work of theorists. So you can take all the data in the world, but if you don't have a hypothesis you're testing your data against, it's like what you may see something new, but you need to understand why that distribution looks the way it does or why the planets behave this way. And so I think making models that we can actually test future data on is really important.
I see. And so this way we at least know enough that when we see something that looks funny, we say, oh, that's funny. Let's pay closer attention to this because it flies in the face of our expectations. And there may be a mundane, normal physics explanation behind it, but there also might be something exotic or spectacular about it, and we can't know unless we have an idea of what we expect and why.
Yeah.
Well, I get that a lot. That makes a lot of sense to me. Brittany, this has been a really deep and really fun conversation. I want to thank you so much for being my guest here on the Starts With a Bang podcast. And before we close this podcast out, I'd love to ask you if you have any final thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners.
So the big thought that I like to share is that, like, just always embrace your natural curiosity for things. It doesn't always have to be science, but just to learn new things and try things out. Because that's one of the main reasons I do what I do. Like, just learning new things and trying them out brings me joy. And, you know, I hope other people embrace the same things for themselves. And that's really important for me, just like, thinking in context of what I do compared to like some of my older family members. I'm lucky to have a job where I can just be curious all the time. And so I hope others explore that in themselves and just be creative. Science is creative, and just learning new things. So that's all I have to say.
You know, I think that's a wonderful message, and it's for everyone out there. You know, the universe is yours. You're just as much a part of it as anyone else out there is. So it's your universe too. Be curious about it and be creative about how you learn about it, because in all the universe, I guarantee you, there's no one else just like you. And we're all made of the same stuff. We all come from the same place. We all have the same shared cosmic history. So thank you to Dr. Brittany Miles. Thank you for Avenues Online for supporting us and being our sponsor. And thanks to all of you for listening out there. The Starts With a Bang podcast is only made possible through the generous donation of our Patreon supporters. So I'd like to thank all of the Starts With a Bang Patreon supporters who support us at the $5 a month level and above. Thanks go to Chad Marler, Jeff Bonwick, Lainey Chuist, Rob Hansen, Samir Kumar, Tim Graham, Aaron Weiss, Chris Jakutas, Dominic Turpin, John Methot, John Van Balaguyan, Matt Conroe, Pattern Shift, Pete Smoyer, Pierre Franson, C. Green Mango, Stefan Bernegger, William Blair, Amira Sosnick, Andean Wall, Benish Tech LLC, Brian Terry, David Charney, David Hibbets, David Wellick, George Church, Girolamo Castaldo, James Franklin, John Kozura, Joseph Dvorak, Kilia Opu, Mark Armstrong, Matt Glasser, Patrick Dennis, Pedro Texera, Ralph L. Weischuk, Randall Slimak, Rick DeWitt, Robert Thibodeau, Ron Schiffman, Sean Foley, Steve Guderian, Adam Robinson, Adrian Griffiths, Alan Parikh, Andres Chovanec, Arnulfo Zepeda, Ben Head, Bob Shire, Brainwise, Brett Minder, Cameron Sowards, Carl Ittings, Casey Haskins, Dan Steele, Dana Bridges, David Taschioni, David Wolf, Diana Nevins, Dick Pills, Dwayne Williams, Flo, Fraser Kane, Glenn McDavid, Ira Cohen, James Bryson Hyatt, James Nance, James Page, Jason Luttrell, Jason McCampbell, Javier Zazo, Catherine S., Kelly Kudrick, Lockwood Carlson, Mark Bergeron, Mark Bloor, Mark Langston, Matt Reno, Michael Hall, Michael Savuto, Naked Bunny with a Whip, Nathan Hanna, Neil Flood, Owen Mann, Pam Harris, Paul Lester, Pavel Zuzelski, Phil Hallenborg, Philip Francis, Rich Weigel, Richard Schwartz, Ron Lyle, Rushin Shah, Steve Nordhoff, Stuart Lendings, Tom Van Scotter, Tomas All, Tomas Walgren, Wayne Pierkarski, Weller Tractor Salvage, William Vandenhoevel, and Young Co. S. Thanks to all of you for tuning in, and I'll see you back here next time for more Starts With a Bang.